I rented out a Zoom.
Yeah, we're going. Okay. Are we recording?
No, okay, it's like $70. Probably the opportunity cost of me going there and having late fees was worse, but
yeah,
that's the principle of it.
Okay. Lovely.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, well, I have disposable income now.
Shall we
and
begin?
No desire to actually do projects outside of work. So.
Since we're never getting mics.
Perfect combo.
What? Since we're not getting mics. Yeah, I know.
Have you been to Elevate Engagement or the first one? You'd probably be into that one. It's a very, very intentional conference, and it's about engagement specifically, like all the engagement practitioners. Last year was in Portland, I think, the first year, and it's supposed to, like, build on each other.
Oh, wait. Like, is this the Agora stuff?
I
can't stand that.
No?
No. But...
I like the people that showed up.
I bet the people
there.
Huh? Yeah, we didn't go sort of out of principle because it was like so expensive, and then they did this really weird like twofer diversity thing that like Daryl then talked to them about, like, hey, this sounds very much like bring your token POC friend, like you should read.
I'm sure it was.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, but
it never happens.
Yeah, I'm really shocked.
Okay.
Sorry.
We didn't pay for that. It's okay.
Yeah, this is the real water cooler talk of a...
Yes. It's exciting. I think we'd like to hear more, but...
Yeah.
I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Anyways, I guess we can begin. Thank you all for coming to the engagement panel. I know it's week 9, so it's hard to make time out of your schedule to come here. But I'm very excited to introduce you to all of our panelists.
Sorry, my phone's
on. Oh, it's okay. And feel free to tweet. They all know that you're going to be tweeting with our hashtag #EngageTheFall, so please tweet and interact with us. Meredith will be live tweeting from our account as well. Thank you for coming, and there will be a section at the end for questions. If any, you have any burning questions that come up at the end, there will be a space for you to ask them. So I will turn everything over to Karina. She's our associate editor, and she's going to moderate the panel.
So we have Andrea Faye Hart here with us. Andrea is an educator and media consultant, formerly of Free Spirit Media, where she created the nonprofit organization's Real Chai Youth Program, which provides teens and young adults in communities of color on Chicago's West and South Sides with a comprehensive foundation in media literacy and hands-on media production experience. She now works full-time on City Bureau's Youth Media Partnerships and Engagement Projects as a co-founder and community engagement director. She says she is working to create journalism that is truly democratic and empowering. Summer Fields is a recent graduate from the University of Chicago, where she wrote her sociology thesis on the opinions of radio producers of color on diversifying public media. She's now an engagement consultant at Herkin, where she works with newsrooms to prioritize their audience's curiosity. She's also an audio producer and podcaster and regular contributor on Vocalo's Feminist Wednesdays.
Does that say recent? I wonder if I didn't send a bio. It was 2 years ago, guys. Pretty recent in the grand scheme of life.
Julian Haida. Julian is a producer for The Worldview, the long-running daily global issues talk show on WBEZ. Before joining Worldview, he was a regular guest of the show. He was most recently a co-founder of the Euromedian Journalist Collective, a nonprofit formed to provide news and analysis to the 2013-2014 revolution and ongoing war in Ukraine. Julian is pursuing a master's degree in international studies from DePaul University, which is where he earned his BA in journalism and digital cinema production. Julian won the Robert D.G. Lewis First Amendment Award for Excellence in Journalism from the Society of Professional Journalists in 2015 and was a finalist for the Pinnacle Award for Best Profile Writing in 2015. So to begin, could we all just, each of you go down and give us kind of your day-to-day experiences with engagement in the workplace?
Sure. So I started at Herkin actually as an intern a couple years ago, and I since became full-time, so that was like right out of college I got into it, so it was awesome. So basically Herkin is a small Chicago-founded and based startup where we work with newsrooms on audience engagement, so we help them actually implement people-powered, public-powered processes of reporting, and it started at WBEZ with a show called Curious City. So our founder, Jen Brendel, started that. and basically the premise is letting the audience ask you questions about what they want to know about the city, letting them vote on their favorites, and then coming along for the reporting process. So basically, when she got that off the ground, a lot of other public radio newsrooms were asking her, like, how do I do this same thing? And so she founded Harkin to make that possible. So been doing that for a couple years, and I work with, like, a couple dozen newsrooms directly.
Yeah, so I think before I explain, like, what engagement looks like from the City Bureau perspective, I want to just kind of clarify, like, engagement to us and how we define it. So I think it's, like, very much a consistent thing. It's not a one-off project-based thing. I think a lot of times when you look at newsrooms, they think about engagement specific to a project, and they don't necessarily have it baked into all of their programming. But City Bureau does. So, like, I serve as the director of community engagement, but it is something that everybody's thinking about. And for me in particular, a lot of it is around looking at community organizations that we can be partnering with for our Documenters program, which is where we, most simply put, it's where we train and pay folks to cover public meetings, but they can go to other trainings and level up into other job opportunities. And you know, with that, like, I'm also always vetting community partners where we could do boot camps. Like, there are a lot of people who are really interested in engaging in the journalism process and reimagining civics and sort of bettering their neighborhoods. And so part of engagement in that is, like, identifying partners that want to collaborate on that project. And then the public newsroom, which we host every week, every Thursday night from 6 to 8, that is, we both get journalists and non-journalists to present, and for us it's a two-way street. Both, like, the presenter is learning something, and then also the audiences as well. And that to us is, I think that's, like, the most easy example of what our engagement process looks like, but it's really designed around learning and unlearning, and that folks can take things with them. It's not just a straight lecture. And so I'm always thinking about what does engagement look like in that way, where, like, it's a two-way learning street. It's not just telling somebody what to do or telling somebody where to go. Those are some of the things that we do on a day-to-day basis. But again, like, it's not just me thinking about it. We have a fellowship three times a year where they're thinking about it in their story process, and then each of the co-founders are thinking about it in the respective work that we do.
So I think I'm the only person on the panel who doesn't have engagement in my title. But I think what could be considered the oldest form of engagement in modern media, and that is work on a daily talk show. And what is really interesting with working with a talk show is, unlike print media, where the journalist mediates and selects quotes, or commercial broadcast television, where a correspondent or an editor chooses sound bites into a 3-minute package. Talk radio, particularly talk shows, are unique in that the journalist is present, but is forced to just, like, shut up and listen, which is, like, the roots of engagement. And I think, you know, there's a lot of debate as to whether or not the medium in its own right is relevant, whether or not it's interesting. But I think it provides a lot of inspiration for people who, for example, follow an issue very closely or care about an issue and feel that journalists can sometimes get in the way of what people are trying to say, that there are certain preconceived notions of what an issue may be that a journalist has, that when they repackage something in a story or a TV spot, gets lost. We do things like call-in shows, which are imperfect, but it's a very old-fashioned kind of way of including an audience. My background, too, as you know, I didn't come to radio very intentionally. While I was covering the revolution in Ukraine, there's something also about being in nonprofit media, kind of not having to worry about the bottom line of an organization. And there's a lot of gray area between nonprofit media and commercial media. But when you're able to cover a mass social movement like a revolution, that is also, I think, requires a certain level of engagement that is grassroots. So if we talk, think of engagement journalism as being grassroots in nature, I think, you know, I learned a lot about finding a story, finding people whose voices wouldn't traditionally be featured in commercial media at the time. In Ukraine, commercial media was state-owned. There was no way in hell that anybody was going to end up in on commercial media or state-owned media. And so to see dozens of grassroots media organizations that, by definition, were engagement journalism. They brought people on who didn't have formal journalism training to really dig into why a social movement was happening, I think is very exciting. And I think the U.S. has a lot of social movements that are happening, and engagement journalism in the formal sense that I'm not involved in has the potential to uncover a lot of where Americans are, but you wouldn't be able to tell in legacy media, especially in the kind of soundbite pull quote format that is so pervasive.
Great. So let's take it back and talk about what you guys were doing before you started working in engagement media, and how did you end up doing engagement work professionally?
Yeah. You want to go first?
Sure.
Shake it up.
Yeah, so I mean, so my background's in like a hybrid of local, or it's in a hybrid of journalism and education. And so most immediately previously to City Bureau, I was working in youth media organizations in the city. And I actually think it's really fascinating how a lot of like more formal journalism is taking a lot from that space and getting respected in a way that doesn't get respected in the youth media space, which I find really fascinating. Mm-hmm. But I had worked at Free Spirit Media and then Radio Arte, which was like one of the best, greatest youth media organizations I think in the country, but was mismanaged by its parent organization, the Museum of Mexican Art. So a lot of what I was doing, I transitioned back into teaching and into that space because I felt like it could be a lot more experimental and actually work with people in the communities to tell their own stories and talk through narratives that weren't getting covered, but then also just this idea of like, what does it look like to share information that you actually matters to you instead of getting told what should matter to you? Mm-hmm. And so that was a lot of what I was doing and incubating. And then also this conversation of civics, like if your media isn't really exclusive, then your civic processes probably are also, or just not as accessible. And so that was where sort of Real Shy Youth came out of, these conversations around how can you also be disruptive in civic spaces through this kind of journalism. But again, like, you know, you can train young folks to do all this work, but if people are still not taking them quite as seriously, it's still limiting. Like, they're only going to be often relegated to, like, these cute little nonprofits, but not necessarily taken seriously. But I think now, like, there's a lot of that I've pulled from that experience and brought into the City Bureau experience, which is, it's also why, like, we encourage and have our fellows mentor young people, because they're often the most affected and the most immediately affected by things happening in the city, but the least talked to, like, they're talked about, but they're not often engaged in that process. So that was kind of most immediately what I was doing right before coming to City Bureau, and like once I had left more traditional news.
Mm-hmm. So I was actually back at UChicago in undergrad in sociology, and so at the time I was trying to like percolate on what do I want to do when I graduate. So I'd founded a podcast back in Chicago, a podcasting organization, not unlike you guys, getting together in this room to teach other like students how to produce audio stories with a focus on the community we were in and the people that were doing cool organizing work or creating things or professors studying fun things like Bob Dylan as from a musicology lens, or like bugs having sex is just everything. So that was fun, and I was really just thinking, like, okay, maybe I'll podcast, maybe I'll audio produce full-time, not sure. But I was passionate about that and about audio art and podcasts. And also at the time, I was hearing a lot of discourse about public radio being, like, something I was just then getting into tangentially, about how public radio is not representative of the public it's supposed to be serving, which is in the very mission of public radio stations, and about how there's this idiom or sort of voice in a literal and metaphorical sense of, like, you know, you picture Ira Glass or 99% Invisible or whatever. It's this very sort of white, middle-class, coastal voice. And it's fun, but it's not the mission if everything sounds like that. So I heard a lot of people talking about that and about how we need to diversify newsrooms and the words of, you know, diversity being invoked in those spaces. So I was like, I think I want to study this, actually, for my thesis. And I used that as an opportunity to talk to, like, dozens of, you know, fellow people of color working within the public radio industry, you know, some white folks who were in it, too, as kind of like, what's your experience also? And just being like, what do you think about the fact that people keep talking about diversity all the time in these vague senses? Like, how does that make you feel as the diversity? So, I don't know, I talk with Julian about that all the time, who is working at BET now. And so that was really great. I was like, this thesis is actually getting me somehow into the world I want to inhabit after college. So at that time, I met Ellen Mayer, who is a good friend of mine now, and she was like, I heard about your thesis. I know you do podcast stuff. I'm about to go work at Harkin. And then a few months later, she's like, I don't know if you're into this. There's an internship at Harkin. Do you want to do that? So I was like, yes, I hopped on that. So that'd be basically working on the community team as, you know, managing the newsrooms who want to be doing public-focused work. So that's how I ended up there. It was all because I started to think about how does journalism change on a more structural level, like not necessarily being a foot soldier just day in, day out doing journalism. I didn't have a ton of experience in newsrooms before I got to Harkin. And I definitely defer to wisdom and people who had years and years of it. But I was like, hey, I'm just going to, you know, get started. So, and the summers before that, I worked at, like, this really boring think tank, and I worked at ABC News Politics during the summer where, you know, every Republican candidate was announcing their election, and that was kind of hell also, but a learning experience, and I was like, I want to do a different kind of journalism thing.
I kind of alluded to it before, but I didn't finish the story. So while our nonprofit was working in Ukraine, I became the go-to voice of the people on the ground who happened to be fluent in English and from Chicago.
Can you explain what Maidan was?
Yes.
Sorry to interrupt, but what the revolution was about and stuff?
There was a very thumbnail version. A little bit over 4 years ago, for fall of 2013, there was it started as a political movement where Ukrainian young people wanted Ukraine to integrate with the European Union. There are a couple hundred people, mostly from two universities, private universities, which are rare in Ukraine. And they, over the course of a couple of days, really got the government really mad at them. And the government had worked very hard to pretend that they cared about basic human rights and civil rights. And after a couple of days, and after a summer of silence, instances of police brutality, about 300 university students from all over Ukraine of several ethnic groups and racial groups were beaten, arrested, and carted off. And the next day, there were 500,000 people in the streets saying the government shouldn't be able to do that. And they set up an encampment in the main city square in Kyiv's capital to demand an investigation of who ordered these arrests. Turns out it went all the way to the top. And it ended after 3 months of peaceful protest of resistance with the president on a helicopter to Russia and the entire National Reserve with around $30,000. So imagine running a country with socialized medicine and a socialized pension system having $30,000 to pay for 45 million people. a police department that was liquidated. All the cops were fired. And a president who, for all intents and purposes, was impeached, and a government that had fled. So I was there during most of that as a senior DePaul journalism student. And I happened to have gone to events that were put on, and I think events, I think my colleagues would agree, events are like the best way to do engagement, or one of the best ways, because it's one thing to like sit on Facebook and solicit questions or something like that. It's another to like meet people face to face. And I'd been to several events that this talk show, Worldview, it's the only thing of its kind, a global media organization, if you could call it that. A globally oriented media organization that's based in Chicago. I mean, the Chicago Tribune, the Sun-Times, they all used to have foreign correspondents. None of them. There's one guy, the Trib, his job is to curate AP stories. Mm. So, like, that's outside bad. Of, like, New York, Boston, D.C., and L.A., nobody does international journalism. And so I was kind of participating in these events, and when they found out that I was in Ukraine, they said, we just can't figure out what's going on there. We have these Americans in D.C. saying what their version of the story. We have the government in Ukraine saying their version of the story. We don't know who to trust. How about you just tell us what happens? And so I was a regular, almost weekly, telling them, like, this is what's happened. You know, barricades are being built. The police are shooting these people, yada, yada, yada. And we built a rapport as our nonprofit and this kind of big time legacy radio station. And I think that is the asset of our show, because there is a network in Chicago of people who cover things like state politics, which is integral. It's very important to cover things like state politics or city politics or schools or. And oftentimes what happens in especially non-engagement circles, it's a bunch of wonks talking to a bunch of wonks. It's a lot of inside baseball. You know, so-and-so politics reporter has been a politics reporter for 20 years who talks to so-and-so source that he's been working with for 20 years in the mayor's office, and they know the lingo, and people read the stories, and they don't click on them because they're boring and because they don't know the lingo and they don't care, even though they do care. And I think our show, the show that I work on now, is unique in that there is no network of international, you know, kind of foreign policy think tanks in Chicago. Even the universities in Chicago are kind of tightening their belts on language programs and international studies programs and stuff like that. And so Worldview depends on events in the city, things like the annual Global Activism Expo, where you have 200 activists who are locally based but globally oriented meeting in the UIC Forum to just talk about what they do. Or ethnic groups here in Chicago. Just today we did a segment with the creator of Radio Islam. I think it's 4:50 a.m. And he a couple months ago created something called the Burma Task Force. And it's just a group of Muslims who are driving to Washington, D.C. today to pressure people to pay attention to what's going on to the Rohingya. Chicago has one of the biggest Rohingya communities in America. And if you were a bicoastal international journalist, or if you were a think tank person, you know, you'd be calling someone in Bangladesh or Myanmar, and you'd be talking to some sort of government official or bureaucrat or something like that, instead of, Imam Mujahid, whose cousin is in a Bangladeshi refugee camp, and he lives next door to us here in Chicago. And so I think that is the value of things like inviting non-government and non-academic groups to events to interact with one another, and then journalists still have the opportunity to curate that conversation, but also step back in the case of the Global Activism Forum or things like roundtable discussions or, I mean, there's a million ways you could format events, but events, I like events, and that's how I met these people. That's how I got this job, was through building that relationship.
Wonderful. So why do you believe engaging readers and viewers is important?
So I'll take it even a level back about, like, what do we mean by engagement? So that's important to know, because you'll hear the word mean a lot of different things. So at Harkin, what we have, like, found and really what we stand by working in, like, 100-plus newsrooms is, so engagement is not just metrics of, like, extraction, like clicks, shares, comments on Facebook, eyeballs on a Facebook Live or something. It's not just extraction from the audience either. So not, you know, not consumption, not extraction, like, okay, user-generated content, polling, stuff like that. If there's no pathway for your audience who's supposed to be consuming your content to have any input on editorial decisions, that is not engagement. So how we define engagement is like a ring, basically, and I think it is kind of like the common parlance a lot of us have is, first, you as a news organization are inviting feedback from your public, then you use that feedback as in or newsroom, or the public engages, then you use that. So you have to take the input and have that shape the editorial content you're doing. So we're fundamentally trying to reshape, like, how do we think of these people that we're interacting with? It's not just viewers. It's not just people who are supposed to consume our content so that, you know, we get ad dollars, because that's not working for newsrooms anymore. You know, a lot of them are closing and dying because they're not going back to this basics of, like, okay, we need to actually figure out what people need to know, because audiences are the ones that ultimately decide what is relevant and popular. And if they feel as though, so the reason why it's important is we cannot afford not to change our relationship with our audience. Because, you know, there's 1,000 ways we can all get our information, but what we're looking to newsrooms for is, I want to trust you that we can get to the truth together in some way. But I can find information through any avenue. So I'm not just looking for something to be delivered to me as an audience member. I want to build trust, and I want to be a collaborator with the newsroom. So that's why it's important. Newsrooms have to evolve in that way. But really, it's not an evolution. It's getting back to, like, what is the core of what journalism is supposed to be.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, it's an accountability thing. Mm-hmm. Like, City Bureau is unapologetically place-based. And we don't really... I think the four co-founders, don't really care about national stuff or, like, non-place-based work, mostly because we, from that accountability perspective, like, we think about how, if you are effectively engaging your audience, it means they can hold you accountable, and there's, like, a lot of transparency. And then it also, for us, means, and we think it's important because we think that journalists should be willing to give up some of their power, and that, like, that's also why it's important to do engage journalism in the way that we do it. Mm-hmm. That, like, if you can give up some of the mystique of journalism and how it's produced, and allow folks to co-produce it with you, not necessarily produce a full-fledged story, but, like, attend a public meeting and document it and submit those notes, that you then just, like, in general, your work is more enriched, and it's also actually something that people are going to use because they feel connected to it. So those are some of the ways that we, like, sort of furthering the definition of engaged journalism and why we think it's important. Part of it is that there's been a lot of problematic dynamics in power dynamics in traditional journalism that hasn't been engaged. And so for us, the importance of engaged journalism is really that it kind of shifts some power dynamics and also opens up the accountability process more, both, like, for your audience to hold you accountable, but then also for them to just generally hold officials accountable where they live. It's allowing people to be better citizens, not citizen journalists, just straight up citizens. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really important.
To build off that, I think there's a constant, like, a tension between, like, arrogance and humility. And I think arrogance often wins. The arrogance to say, I know what the audience wants, I know what the audience needs, and I read about this thing, and therefore it's interesting to me, and because of that, I think we need to talk about it. And that works sometimes, especially if your audience is like you. But I think it takes a lot of humility and a lot of, as you said, Andrew, to kind of step back and say, I don't know what's important to some people. And I have the skill set as a journalist to go after something, perhaps a skill set that a member of the public doesn't have, or even the time and resources to do that. But I don't always know how, I don't always know what is the story that the community needs, as opposed to the story that I want. And it's really difficult, I think, to do that. I mean, there's the old adage that crap. What's the phrase that's really popular? Like, hold. Maybe someone can help me out.
About what?
Holding people to power.
Truth to power.
Yeah, right? Truth to power. But there's also like to make the comfortable uncomfortable, and to comfort the discomforted.
Oh,
what
yeah.
What was that line? That was like a...
Sounds a little biblical.
A mantra.
Well, that's like the role of journalism,
yeah.
Right? It's to like comfort the...
Right.
Interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's awfully easy to become comfortable as a journalist, though.
Mm-hmm.
And if we're supposed to speak truth to power, well, power isn't necessarily an elected position. Power isn't necessarily... you know, government. Power can also be your, you know, public radio station's underwriters.
Yeah.
It could be people who say that engagement journalism doesn't work. We do know what's best because we paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it could be a whole lot of, there's a lot of power. There's a lot of power.
And newsrooms are not buying into what we do necessarily.
Yeah.
There's like it's a really painful culture change.
I mean, racial dynamics, it's always a struggle on us as a talk show. And I'm saying this fully aware that I'm a white man who works in public radio, but it's really easy to find, and I'm talking, it's awfully easy to find a white man willing to talk because they have the power to do so, and often the time and the resources and to find someone to talk about something, an issue that maybe is equally or more important to them, is hard. It's our mission to do that, because when we have powerful people, whether it's just because they're social standing, talk about issues, that's not holding power as a concept accountable. And so we try to go out of our way to have people speak for themselves as opposed to speak for them. Journalism, I don't think, is there yet culturally. I mean, it is at City Bureau, and it is at the newsrooms that subscribe to Harkin, but...
Sometimes.
But halfway. It's always a struggle.
Yeah.
It's always a struggle.
So what does engagement do for a newsroom?
Where do we want to start?
Critics.
It depends on how much you put into it, like your commitment. And it depends on, like Andrea said, you only kind of get as much as you put into it in terms of, like, is it a siloed thing where you're like, there's one project where we let our audience have input, ask questions, whatever, and it doesn't really permeate how we do things in the rest of our coverage. That can be successful and your audience can feel listened to in that way, but like the ideal would be, could each time you think of a project or a new vertical or a beat you're doing, any topic you're covering, could you think about like where does the audience come into this in the process and how does the editorial process like involve the information needs of our audience? So I think if people are doing engagement to that extent, that means they're fulfilling a mission, I guess. If they're a public radio newsroom, not every newsroom has to have that mission. They're for profit, but they should. And you know, the audience responds well to feeling as if they're represented in the work you do and that their curiosities are represented, and that often looks like more traditional metrics can go up too for a newsroom, like people do want to read this more often. You'll get more newsletter subscribers that become public radio members and stuff like that. So you can get bang for your buck on this, but that's not the only thing you're going after as a newsroom. So it's a lot, but editorially, there's a lot more to say about it, but I'll stop.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I was saying before, like, it makes the newsroom give up some of its power and its control. I think that's a lot of what it looks like. It means that you're not, you know, with our fellowship, we tell the fellows straight up that some of what they produce could be a story, and they might not ever produce a story during the time as a fellow, because it's sort of, they give that up based on, like, the engagement they're doing. They allow that process. They allow the process to dictate. They trust the process. Mm-hmm. So I think in that way, like, the question was, like, what does it look like for newsrooms? Is that it?
What does engagement do for a newsroom?
Yeah, so I think in that way, like, it's definitely a giving up of control and power. I think it can make the newsroom feel pretty chaotic, but not necessarily in a bad way. Mm-hmm.
It destabilizes initially, definitely.
Yeah.
Like, because you have to really think about changing how you do your editorial process, and it's hard. And often there's not staff to make engaging on a long-term basis possible. Like, you have to commit to it. So.
Yeah, totally. And I think it allows, ideally and hopefully, it allows for your newsroom to take more of an asset lens approach to, like, the places it's reporting on instead of a deficit lens. So it allows you to see that, oh, there are these existing community groups who are really high functioning and are, like, doing amazing work in this neighborhood that's often only covered around because when a murder happens or things like that. So I think that it allows you to have a more asset lens. And like, the other side of that is, and this is a theory that we talk a lot about at City Bureau, is, like, it allows you to operate from a space of abundance instead of a space of scarcity. So you sort of realize that, like, there's a lot that we can work with instead of getting really weirdly competitive and like, weirdly secretive. Mm-hmm. So I think those are some of the, if you do it well and, like, you do it consistently, I think those are some of the benefits. It's like, but it's a growing process. It's a painful process, but it's worth it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Can I speak a little bit about that point about, like, scarcity and hard news bias? So a lot of what we're animated by with a lot of the projects we work with at Harkin, it started from Curious City, like I said, and the premise of that was people have questions about the place they live often, or about a topic even, but usually, like, the place they live, they walk down the street, they see things, they observe things about the place they're in that are not just, like, trauma, and that are not just, like, some exceptional thing. So it's, like, often what you see in news is this gulf between, like, if it bleeds, it leads, that whole thing, like, something horrible happened in this community, we're going to parachute in and cover this terrible thing that's so unfortunate. And often you see whole communities, that's the only way they make it into the news. And communities come to resent that. And it's like, if you talk about the South Side from this certain lens, or the West Side in these broad strokes, whatever, and you don't really serve them, you just talk about them, there's no reason they should trust you. Or you could go into that community and say, oh, you had this 7-year-old who just broke the Guinness World Record, and isn't that great? And then you also leave. So the idea is there's this whole thing in the middle of, like, mundanity and curiosity, and often just, like, I need practical information about where I am. So the idea is, as a newsroom, you want to open it up back to that gulf, and often, like, curiosity series where people can just ask questions, which is what a lot of my newsrooms will do, just, like, lets you be more open-ended and not, like, and you do have this humility of, like, I'm not going to necessarily set the agenda for my audience. I'm going to let them say, like, you know, this is just curiosity I had, and that's where it starts. Yeah. So you definitely have to be humble, and the audience has to be humble in that exchange. So whether it's a specific topic you're letting them ask about, like, what do you need to know about how Illinois's politics function, or if it's just, like, what do you want to know about Chicago, they're not asserting, like, I know something, so you should cover it. They're asserting, like, I would like to know something from you in collaboration with you. So instead of, like, the constant lack of humility both on the side of journalists and newsrooms, there's this space where we all could be humble.
To talk about how, like, oftentimes journalists kind of parachute into a place and to kind of focus on the mundanity of a place, there's a funny example. It wasn't sourced out of an engagement project necessarily, but I think it does destabilize also some of the audience, like what the audience is expecting. Yeah. I think there's a lot of an audience, especially an audience where has come to accept news as kind of like a passive act, mm-hmm. that they just kind of let it wash over them. Mm-hmm. And Dave Eggers, he's a famous writer. He wrote a book based on the doorman at his condo building who was traveling to Yemen to work on revitalizing Yemen's ancient coffee industry. They say mocha was invented in Yemen.
And coffee in general.
And coffee has its roots in Yemen. And so he would go to Yemen as, you know, a young man in San Francisco and come back, and he met this author and they were writing. And so we had this guy, this former doorman turned coffee importer from Yemen, which is, as most people would begin to describe, as a war-torn, ravaged country. Mm-hmm. And he was just a guy, a U.S. citizen. His parents were from Yemen. He lived in San Francisco, and he just wanted to talk about the coffee. And, of course, when you talk about the coffee, you have to talk about the war. But oftentimes people talk about the war and feel that the coffee isn't worth mentioning. I mean, it's a template. It's like, this is a war-torn country, and you mm-hmm. can apply that to Chicago. This is a war-torn neighborhood, and this is a war-torn neighborhood, and there's nothing unique about them. Mm-hmm. But when you talk about the coffee and about the people who live there in Yemen, and you'd be like, wow, this is a place that is important. And it's funny, we're talking about Yemeni coffee, and we talked about the war, and one of the issues with live radio is this, someone can turn on the radio halfway through the conversation mm-hmm. and miss the first half. But we got angry tweets being like, how dare you talk about something as cute as coffee in a country where tens of thousands of people have cholera? And so, well, we mentioned the cholera, but in addition to the cholera, there is also a vibrant coffee yeah. industry, and there's joy, and there are people there, and people live there, and people... and I think that, you know, just kind of humanizing people is... vital. Also, I think what engagement does to a newsroom, I think it helps people draw connections. Mm-hmm. So we often hear from our bosses as an international issues talk show, a global issues talk show. We use the word global issues as important because things like race, class, gender, you know, kind of corruption, environmental issues, these are global issues. They don't know borders. And, you know, when we talk to somebody, you know, when we do have, you know, our show engages with community organizations, ethnic community organizations in Chicago, and we'll meet someone who's Congolese, well, a lot of Congolese people, or actually a lot of Ethiopians, too, on the north side, have, you know, they live a hybrid life. They're not white Americans. But they're, you know, they're also kind of, say, Ethiopian or Congolese American, and so they care about the conflicts in those countries. But they also participate in the day-to-day life of their neighborhoods. So it's a weird, I think more people in the city, it may seem like two separate stories. But when they come to, you know, an international story that happens on page 6 of the New York Times, or a local story, which happens on page 2 of the Chicago Tribune. I mean, they're separate papers, for Christ's sake. Yeah. And for a lot of people, both of those stories are the same story. Mm. Like, I came here because of an inter-ethnic conflict in Ethiopia, and I experienced police brutality in Ethiopia, and holy crap, am I in America, and I'm seeing police brutality, and I'm seeing a government that's doing these things. And what we can do then is be, you know, we can say, this is happening in Ethiopia. This is happening in America. Let's open up a dialogue. What's going on here? And that better represents, I think, people's lived experience as opposed to kind of partitioning things as being global news, national news, local news. Because mm-hmm. oftentimes, local stories are national or international just because people are national, international. And I think realizing that is something that's missing in especially media that kind of is hyper-local.
So there's a tension here on the panel of no. We all focus on so many different you said you're unapologetically place-based, very rooted here in some way, mm-hmm. and you're thinking about, like, how do we co-suffer as a global community?
We're also local, though.
Yeah.
Like, we're a local talk show about global issues.
And a lot of public radio audience. Stations are eradicating their local coverage.
So but anyway, that's too weird, deep it's a weird
rabbit hole. So.
But I yeah.
can draw connections to the rest of the
world. You
can
draw connections. People will find solidarity and engagement.
Yes. And that's the secret mission of Worldview is to help people then struggle and fight. But they're not allowed to say that because they're objective journalists, which brings us to question you had, right?
Yes. So my next question is, when it comes to incorporating the community into your reporting, is there a point, hypothetical or not, at which the public engagement just crosses a line? Can your audience ever be too involved?
Mm-hmm. I thought you were going to ask us about objectivity.
I guess that sort of is, isn't it?
I mean, it kind of is.
Yeah. Depends on... Well, someone else start.
The question's like, where's the line?
Yeah.
Basically.
Where's the line in any journalism?
I mean, yeah, we don't necessarily have community people full-fledged doing, reporting, necessarily. I mean, we have this, even within our fellows, we have a lot of conversations about this, because our fellows have experiences, lived experiences in Chicago, and we look at that as, an asset. You know, we've had activists, quote-unquote activists, people would call them activists, come into our fellowship, but they get, when they're in the fellowship space, that the goal is not necessarily to be an advocate, it's to just kind of be more of an organizer, and allow folks to make decisions themselves, but sort of using the lens of the problematic stuff that you've seen as an activist. So I mean, so that's the line for us. It just really depends on which program you're engaging with. If you're a fellow, there's certain expectations. If you're a documenter, there are different expectations. If you're a participant in the public newsroom, we want you to bring in your lived experience even more explicitly. I guess the line for us, the line fluctuates depending on which way you're engaging us. But yeah, I mean, we still, as long as we're abiding by truth, and being factual and being accurate, those things, mm-hmm. I think that's more of what, that line shouldn't be crossed or compromised.
Mm-hmm. With Harkin, the vast majority of it is a really specific public-powered process, and often that helps to just codify what the relationship between the newsroom and the audience is. So that is, at what would traditionally be the pitch phase. You have your audience ask you questions about a topic. At the assignment phase, they get to vote on what they most want to see answered, usually. And at the reporting phase, they come along for the process. So it is a very, formulaic way to go about it, and it helps both kind of members of the exchange to be the most productive. So it comes from a place of questions, because the audience knows how to ask questions. It's the atomic unit of all journalism, because we ask questions as a starting point of telling stories. And but I would say, and you know, sometimes it only goes as far as who is your audience as a newsroom to begin with, and you have to do outreach and try to really be critical about how do we reach beyond who we're already reaching.
Yeah.
But, you know, so I would say that's been a really productive relationship between audience and newsroom, and a lot of newsrooms have gone out of their way to think about, the reason I want to do Harkin for, my education reporting, for instance, is, I'm sick of just engaging the policy-focused education folks in Milwaukee, and I want to go to parents and kids. So what outreach strategy can we develop so that they can ask me questions and stuff like that, and they can find me?
Yeah.
But... yeah, so I would say it usually doesn't go too far when you're hey, audience, this is the process, and you can be open to, what happens within that. But, you know, it's telling, reporting is a skill, and people can definitely learn it and get the tool, and I think it can be democratized, just everyday folks and community. But, I don't know. Also, reporters have a lot of priorities put on them. So I get where it comes to be too much, not from a vague, moral journalism standpoint, but it's just not everyone like, there's journalists just have way too many expectations put on them in day-to-day life in newsrooms. They just have way too many competing priorities, and that's unfair, and our budgets are being cut left and right. So, like, hopefully we can come to a place where it's, like, fundamentally you're engaging the community as part of the work you do, and it is not siloed and extraneous. But not all newsrooms are set up for that.
Right. I mean, I think the other thing, too, that you're making me think about, too, is this, like, I think some of it is, like, and it's why City Bureau is so explicitly addressing diversity issues in newsrooms is the problem a lot of times with, like, when people think of objectivity or when they've used that and thrown that in the face to, like, not do certain kind of engagement.
Yeah.
Really, objectivity has meant, like, a white male perspective, and, like, that's what's objective.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think, like, it's hard to kind of answer that question a little bit because we kind of don't know what, I don't even know if you really can ever achieve objectivity, but I think, like, for us, the biggest thing is, like, as long as we're not centering that,
mm-hmm.
we're doing a good job.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's sort of, yeah, like, a case-by-case basis to, like, figure out what's the line on engagement.
Has anybody had Jason Martin for a class here? Anybody? Talk to him sometime, because he teaches a class, not always, about, like, law, ethics, and journalism. Have you taken anybody?
My roommate took that class.
What?
My roommate took that class.
It's very good. He has really good takes. I think there's a myth that objectivity means, like, non-ideological, like, to be fair and balanced, which, I mean, we all know where that phrase is most popularly used, and it's really funny. But, like, of course there's ideology in journalism.
And even the people that are looked at as, like, you can be the arbiter of issues
yeah.
without being invested in it. Yeah.
And what I mean by that, and what Jason's take is, and I'm going to borrow this, and fully attributing, as is good journalistic practice, we couldn't do our jobs if it weren't for the right to free press. We couldn't do our jobs if there were no right to assembly, if there weren't no right to free speech. And there was a time in this country where to be for free speech was a political stance. And there are parts of the world where to be for the free press is a political stance. It is an opinion. And there are many people who still don't believe in a free press. It is their political stance to not have a free press. The kind of gaslighting that we're seeing around the term fake news is an example of that. It's an erosion of the free press before our very eyes. And so objectivity is, and this is a whole other issue, to kind of bring it back to engagement, is to recognize that people are human and there are still certain things that allow them, principles that allow them to move within the world or restrict their movement within the world. And to let someone speak for themselves is, I think, the most true to journalistic thing you could do.
Mm-hmm. And don't use the phrase "give voice to the voiceless" ever. It's not that. It is, like, amplifying conversations that are already happening because, like, there's a world outside of our newsrooms. So conversations, community pathways we could really, like, defer to. So, but that's just the tip. Don't use that. Sometimes it is, though, if you're being, you know, killed for, I don't know.
And then human rights. I mean, basic human rights are journalistic. Are our journalistic values. We choose our stories because someone's getting killed. Well, I mean, we could just not care.
Mm-hmm.
But is that objectivity? I mean, mm-hmm. if a white man cares about a place, does that make it worse? I mean, there's a global map of journalism tragedies, and it happens, like, if there's a civil war in Africa, where's the meter of someone caring? High or low?
Mm-hmm.
If there's a bombing in Paris, everybody's familiar with the tricolor, the French tricolor Facebook avatar. When do they care? Who decides to care about that?
When is it a meme to care about?
Yeah. And a lot of that has to do, I think, with journalists who don't care about objectivity deciding what is important.
Yeah.
Whereas when there is a church bombing in Egypt and Chicago's massive Coptic community comes to us and says 300 churchgoers have been killed before it's even on the BBC, you know that there are people who care about this who can't even turn to local media to learn about what's happened to their loved ones. Mm-hmm. And I think that channel of communication needs to be maintained and respected.
Yeah.
Because every person, this is a political stance, one could argue, every person's joy and suffering matters.
Mm-hmm.
And I hate to say that radical equality has to be argued for.
Yeah.
And that is somehow not objective when you give equal screen time to a church bombing in Egypt as to a concert shooting in Paris.
Yeah.
Well, I think you started to touch on this a little bit, so I'm going to kind of direct this question to you, but it is open to everybody. Historically, we've thought of journalism as this removes a state from day-to-day life, which has allowed journalists to be objective. How would you respond to the idea that by becoming involved in a community or audience, you sacrifice judgment?
Who was the you were referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. Julianne.
Me?
Yeah.
You have experiences with this. I don't know how frank you'll be.
I think you started to touch on it a little bit earlier.
That's so ridiculous. That is like a racist. Yeah, that's like a racist and fucked up. It's just funny. It's like, okay, so I'm a black woman and I care about the fact that black people are being killed disproportionately in the street. Is the fact that I want to cover that a fair and equal amount somehow biased? A lot of newsrooms would say, yeah, there's a limit on how much you could talk about this very obvious issue. Like, if you're a part of any sort of, like, ethnic or, you know, it's like, you can't talk about an issue or an identity issue too much, you know? So, but then, like, if you are somehow a blank receptacle and you can look at the world with this objective gaze, like, you can talk about and pick and choose anything you want to pitch. So it's kind of ridiculous. It's like, do you want your newsroom to be an equitable place where everyone can bring their selfhood to bear on it? Do you really care about diversifying the audience you're reaching? Do you really care about diversifying whose voices make it onto your airwaves or into your publication? Then you have to let people show up. Be fair, be truthful, and be factual, but bring their whole selves. And don't act like, okay, I'm a black woman, but I'm not going to talk about anything that relates to, you know, the things that I suffer and care about because I don't want to seem non-objective. So we have to change our standard for, like, what does that look like?
Yeah. And you can be invested.
Yeah.
But objective.
Yeah.
You can be objective.
And everybody is in their own communities. But it's like, what is considered some blank, you know, community and what is considered some sort of, like, yeah.
Because if your personal mission is to serve or help a community, you know, a lie of omission or a lie won't help anybody.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, you could say, this is what's going on. Based on my research, using this toolbox that I've picked up in J school, I have discovered that these are some of the faults with our community and or the people who interact with our community. And where journalism stops and activism begins is when you say, well, with this information, this is what we're going to do.
Yeah.
So the best you can do is provide the most accurate information. And you can be invested to do that. You can be invested. But I think a lot of people, particularly the gatekeepers, are afraid of that. Very, 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 very afraid of that because they just don't trust you to be thorough with self-criticism.
Yeah, I mean, I just think, like, you can't ask questions of objectivity if, like, internally you're not an equitable workspace.
Yeah.
Like if you've already thrown equity out the window internally, then I don't trust you to be objective. And so, like, I think that's, those conversations need to happen first, and, like, that framework needs to be more, because you're never going to be objective if you're not equitable. Like, you've already made a choice to, mm-hmm. like, prioritize something or someone over someone else.
Mm-hmm.
So.
That's a good point.
So, next question. What are some examples of engagement done well?
Mm.
both like that we've done or that we've seen?
Either or.
Yeah, either or. I mean, I really loved ProPublica's recent investigation into like Black mothers and like the pregnancies and like how the mortality rate is so high for Black women and like their real thoughtfulness in how they approached women of color who were having babies, and then also even how they were super transparent about all of it. I think it's something that, you know, is really valuable. Like, it shows that they're really invested, and then it also allowed people to engage with it in different ways. Like, I didn't have to have read the story to actually get the data, and I think that's really interesting. Like, I think it appeals to different kinds of readers, which I liked. Like, someone who might just be into investigative work and someone who's just interested in the issue, which I think is important. Yeah, that's like a recent thing that I thought was pretty great.
I'm going to go to the bathroom. Sorry.
I think that as I mentioned earlier, by nature, places where there is conflict do engagement very well. They don't call it engagement, but when people who are untrained in journalism all of a sudden find themselves doing journalism, I think it comes to them a lot more naturally. And as I mentioned, just in my personal experience, when I was on the grounds of a revolution, a literal revolution that, you know, it changed the course of a country forever, you know, it was the people who blocked. I mean, it was the people who built a reputation of objectivity and of self-criticism in a way that was relatable. I think relatability, you know, when you read something and say, oh yeah, that makes sense, I think, you know, that helps build trust, especially when a system is shattered and then has to get rebuilt out of nothing. And so I've seen it done. I've seen engagement journalism done really well. Engagement journalism, despite itself, it doesn't call itself engagement journalism, but it's the kind of journalism that doesn't, you know, interrogate, not even interrogate, just kind of half-heartedly question bureaucrats, or the kind of people we traditionally sense as those in power, are in places like, you know, there's a newspaper called the Irrawaddy. It is a newspaper that was created by Rohingya refugees around 15 years ago, none of which had any journalism experience. They live in Thailand. And they have a pulse on what's happening because they don't really follow the same formulas. I know there's been the journalists would. I know that there's... there have been some ideas, I think a couple of years ago at Columbia University, they had the idea of you can't just be a journalism major. You have to double major in something, anything else. I think finding expertise in something else is invaluable. Just because it'll make you a better... I mean, the one-size-fits-all journalism is very profitable. I was talking... not to be too shady, but like the Chicago Tribune, they have this one international editor who curates AP stories, and occasionally when a story has such a, like, in-your-face local angle, they'll send a general assignment report to cover it. Someone who, best case scenario, has a couple of days to read up on the subject that they'll be covering. It's really easy to do that, because it makes you very marketable as a journalist. It's easy to hire people who have journalism experience but don't have experience covering a beat or a subject area, and I think a lot of media organizations are moving away from that, because when you have expertise in an area in your own right, I think you're willing to talk to more people than if you're a general assignment reporter and you just go to the expert and or government official who's listed on a website and ask them what you have to do and call it day. you can network better. I mean, I can keep going on and on. But again, that's engagement journalism despite itself. It's not called engagement journalism, but it's a dying form of journalism.
How do we get to that, to what you were talking about at the end there?
I'll tell you later.
Okay. Sorry. I've never had to pee mid-panel before, but today.
It's a long one.
Yeah.
So when have you seen engagement done poorly? Or not being able to really capture the readers?
When people use the word engagement wrong. To mean like their social media person who retweets stuff. That's not engagement. But that's unfortunately what people think of.
Yeah. I think the Sun-Times has provided a lot of great examples of like not good engagement lately. As has like other traditional outlets. I think when you have folks who are, we're going to humanize this issue, like there's some danger and trickiness there too, where like the engagement is more to like placate white folks than it is to like actually address an issue. I think anytime you're seeing engagement be like this like really sensational thing, or when it's this like exotifying thing, that's where I see it not working and being crappy.
And sometimes it replicates stuff that's wrong and not being addressed about what how the newsroom covers stuff. And even with curiosity-based theories, I'm sometimes frustrated thinking like, well, I don't want to go too that far, but is it like just for transplants that are like, what's this quirky neighborhood? Or is it like people that, I don't know, live in the area and are you reaching them to begin with?
And actually, like, in that regard, I kind of wish people were a little more explicit, like, about who this is for.
Yeah.
Like, when I think engagement is bad is, like, when people are lying to themselves about who they think the piece is for.
Yeah.
Like, I think about, like, I had some issues with the hour-long radio piece that Linda Lutton did about the view from 205 because, like, I felt like this story has been heard before and a lot of people are involved in it and like know this story, so then my question is like, who is this for? And I think to her, she thinks it's for everybody, but it's not, like, I think, and I wish like people would be more explicit about who this stuff is for, like if your thing is there really to like help other like people who aren't from here to understand what's happening, and then also in particular like folks who might be able to leverage their power like to do something about it, then like be more explicit about that. Whereas, like, yeah, I think that people, like, lie to themselves when they think it's for everyone. Mm-hmm. Like, I'm not for everyone, and that's fine. Like, I don't want to be. Mm-hmm.
It's really, really funny you mentioned that, because I remember watching a presentation, and I can't give away too much, about the expansion of the education desk at WBEZ.
Yeah.
And one of the first rhetorical questions that were put up on the slideshow were, who is this for?
Yeah.
And they're like, well, it's for parents of children in CPS. It is for voters in Chicago. And it's for general interest, because some people just find it interesting to follow stories of education.
Yeah.
And so it's for everybody. And when we as a show, Worldview, has to defend our existence, we say, it's for everybody?
Yeah.
They say, no, it isn't. That's not interesting. Why would anybody care about that? It's like, well, because you don't care about it. Because you're all excited about the soap opera that is Chicago Public Schools, and you think it's just some sort of, like, exciting, exotic thing to peer into from your suburban lifestyle. Sorry, I've revealed too much. it's...
You're not allowed to be critical about how they make coverage decisions?
I am. So the audience of a radio station... A very, very, very small
off
percentage.
Off the record, don't tweet this.
A very, very, very small percentage of our audience has children in Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah.
And we have four people covering Chicago Public Schools.
Yeah.
Which is important, because they need to be held accountable as a place where that educates so many people. But there are private schools. There are suburban schools. There are suburban, I mean, there are schools in low-income suburbs. Yeah. That, you know, if we're going to make it a sort of paternalistic, you know, here we are from our privileged Navy Pier ivory tower, God damn, I'm getting carried away.
That's because I'm here and feel emboldened because I'm prodding you.
Yeah.
So I think we're going to move over to our Q&A session.
Now we were finally talking.
It's messed up. I forgot where my point was.
Yeah.
It's messed up. It's broken when the people in power feel that they're doing a good job already.
Yeah.
When the people in power, and I don't mean like I mean management, says we know it's important. And in many ways, yes, covering CPS is important, but our radio station reaches 3 states.
Mm-hmm.
And 9 million people, a third of which live in Chicago, an even smaller percentage. I mean, there's a lot to cover, and when most of your audience lives in the northern suburbs, it becomes suffering porn. It becomes, mm-hmm. look at this poor school district,
yeah.
with all of this corruption and all these people. Aren't you glad in Evanston that your schools are better?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Because why don't you abandon Chicago? Because it's so horrible.
Yeah.
I'm done.
So, Q&A. Does anybody in the audience?
Yeah. I think that it's really great.
Thank you.
And also, I think I'm curious about how you can do engagement when your audience isn't city-based. Like, I'm imagining podcasts, mm-hmm. when your audience is mostly virtual, or with Worldview, a lot of it is all across different areas. Like, how can you have them be engaged at different levels with reporting and pitching and everything when
mm-hmm.
they're not there physically?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it depends on who's, like, what your project is and what the scope is. Like, a lot of what we advise newsrooms on is kind of like a digital first strategy as like the core of it. So it's like you have this place where you drive people to and you say, this is where you can ask us questions and vote, and this is where you can see what came out of the questions you guys asked. And then you push that far. But then we also come up with like, what is the outreach strategy of like, how do you even reach beyond the normal listeners in your local listening area and like go to people in the communities you want to engage that you don't already, et cetera. And if it's national, I mean, it is a similar digital strategy of, like, how do you meet people where they are? That's what we ask people. Like, do you have a newsletter where you're talking to people in that way, or, like, social media, whatever? Or are you actually hitting the streets and, like, talking to folks? Or are you partnering with your local library? But that's local. But, you know, so if it's national, it's like having a really good digital strategy where you're transparent and you tell people, here's how the process of you being in touch with us works.
Our audience, we know where they live because our radio antennas only reach so far.
Yeah.
Even though we often get surprised where people download our podcasts from, which is everywhere. Mm. But in some cases, we are unapologetically local in the sense that our audience is always those people who live between Northwest Indiana and Southeast Wisconsin, and everywhere in between. So it's often difficult to figure out who is listening. I think particularly with the kind of ethnic communities that we engage with, there is a lot of we often have to kind of, maybe it's like leading by example, where a local community group. For example, a couple of weeks ago, or about a month or two ago, I drove by on the far north side. There's a Kyrgyz cultural center, Kyrgyz community center. And I was like, no kidding. You know, Kyrgyzstan, it's a country we don't talk about often on the show, which in some cases is a good thing because we talk about a lot of countries that are in the news for unpleasant reasons. And I said, you know, and I started digging, and it turns out Chicago has a really big, one of the biggest in America, Kyrgyz communities. Kyrgyzstan. It's a country that most people don't even know how to, like, pronounce. And I emailed them and they said they all listened to the show. They all, like, everybody listens to the show. And they just said they just didn't know how to approach us. Mm. They just didn't know, and I'm afraid, and there's a lot of truth to this, that we're still, I mean, you know, the Chicago Tribune, it's leaving the Tribune Tower, but it's a tall building with gargoyles. It looks like a castle. You know, you don't walk in and be like, I have this story. Mm-hmm.
And there's no pathway to do that.
WBEZ is in the middle of Lake Michigan.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I mean, yeah, these other places... You what?
It's like a headache to get
It's
there.
Awful. Yeah. It's so awful.
Yeah.
And people, like, don't... Like, they just... I mean, and these are literal manifestations of how people feel. We are out of reach. They don't even know who to email or who to call. And when they do, they just run into operators. And so it's funny that they just were kind of so meek that they just didn't know how to get to us. And what we have to just keep doing is keep inviting community organizations on to make people feel empowered to approach us.
And you have to be meta about it too, which
yeah.
is a huge part of this process of, like, no matter how broad the audience is, you have to tell them, by the way, this is what we're doing. We let you into the process. Here's where you could do it. And then you'll see potentially the answer to your question here. Or we invite community groups to be on our show. You could be one of those. And so it's like you have to be really transparent, which we've kind of lost in some forms of journalism. So.
But now we know that if we cover Kyrgyzstan, there'll be people listening. You can.
It's hard to know who your audience even is sometimes.
Yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Anywhere, even if you are engagement journalism, it's an issue with. I think it's just always a challenge. I mean, you could really work hard to find who your audience is, but I think. I think engagement journalism as a category within journalism as a form of is still young in the sense that people are still used to consuming media in a passive way.
So both ways, and like
yeah.
the audience isn't used to being invited.
Right.
What's your podcast about?
Oh, I was like imagining like podcast Gimlet, like Uncivil or
mm-hmm.
Reply All or stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
On
their show, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, the more you can explicitly point folks in a direction of, like, this is where you would approach us or
yeah.
interact with us, the better.
Right.
But, like, you should do it consistently and, like, do it often.
Right.
Need a big team for that.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily. I think, like, depending on what you're doing with it, maybe, but, like, I think, having it just out, like, letting it be known that, like, this is how people can engage with you, like, that's something that you can do pretty easily, but, like, depending on what you're trying to do with it, maybe, you know.
Yeah, because there is a danger if you say, we invite you, we want your questions, but then there's no, like, way that makes it into the editorial process or it just isn't a priority, then there is a danger in acting like that's true. So you have to make good on it.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
How can student media incorporate engagement into their processes, not just for one piece, but really like the foundation of different outlets at universities?
Mm-hmm. Don't be afraid to talk to people. It's your job as journalism students to get the hell over being afraid to talk to strangers. I heard about some Harkin students that were like afraid to do that because we do work with them directly with some colleges and like some you know, journalism programs that are the ones doing like man on the street gathering questions, doing the reporting. Some of them were like afraid to be going out getting questions. So get over that. You need to realize that your job is about like who are we trying to reach with this? Who are we actually serving with the work we do? So your friends are that community or,
yeah.
you know, depending on the coverage you're doing, it could be people across Chicago. Like how do you plug into community partnerships or spaces where people are convening and like your local library is great for that. You could go to Harold Washington and approach them about like, what if we did like a community engagement series? Like that is a very efficient model of doing audience engagement. So yeah, make yourself available and realize it's a part of your job. To do your job well, you need to be able to talk to people.
Yeah. I mean, some of it's like being, again, like being realistic about like what's the relationship your institution has with the communities you're trying to cover. Like, mm-hmm. I think having everybody on the same page about that is really important. But then outside of that, I think like being willing to take, you guys can kind of take more risks because you're not like, this is an that's the opportunity to do so. So I think being willing to do that, but like being really honest about that relationship that your institution, like, you know, I went to Northwestern, I went to Medill, and like it's a, like that relationship is very real. The lack of a relationship, I should say, between the city and the university. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so like, I think that's the first step, and then once you've sort of identified that, you'd be willing to take risks. And like, I think you guys do a good job of like emulating the things that you think are doing well, which is great. And I think you could do that, you know, no problem.
As a DePaul grad, I think, like, I remember a conversation that this was before 14th. Existed, but about the DePaulia and who that serves, and also about who makes up the journalism program versus what are the demographics of the student body. I mean, DePaul is one of the biggest, I think between DePaul and UIC are some of the biggest commuter schools, four-year colleges in the city. DePaul teaches a lot of non-traditional age students. But oftentimes the people you have volunteering to write and practice are, you know, dorm living Lincoln Parkers. And the first step in doing effective journalism is to getting to know who your audience is. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of also, I think I remember reading about the demographics of the journalism program. A lot are from out of state. Mm-hmm. So you have the Chicagoans coming to DePaul for computer science or whatever. And then you have, out of state DePaul students who are just discovering the city, but then are also writing authoritatively about it. Mm-hmm. And so I think engagement is an opportunity for people to get to know who their fellow students are, not just in their program, but also the university at large. Mm-hmm. Did you know that DePaul has, DePaul had 10 years ago, 7 campuses. There was a Loop campus, a Lincoln Park campus, an O'Hare campus, a Lake Forest campus, there's a Naperville campus, a Rolling Meadows campus. And those have all closed, or are about to close. I wonder if a lot of that just has to do with institutional neglect. And the students there and the faculty there not really being included in university culture, in university life. Mm. So much so the university gave up on it. And I think that's a horrible loss for the university. And I remember being in a journalism class talking about, it's funny, the DePaul O'Hare campus, if anybody's familiar with Des Plaines, Illinois, where the Rivers Casino is, mm-hmm. that's where the old O'Hare campus used to be. They demolished they demolished DePaul's campus. It was a beautiful campus. I mean, there were like 4 buildings, and there was like a fountain, and there was like a quad, and like it was a campus for the university. They demolished it, and nobody talked about it. There were like 4,000 students who took classes there in a given year, and then they moved into a new campus, which was in this like office park, and they did upgrades and all yada yada yada. And I just mentioned it in one of my journalism classes that like, oh yeah, my mom works at the O'Hare campus, and they're like, the what? Mm. If we're talking about the struggle between humility and arrogance, you don't know everything about university your first year here, or your second year here, or your third year. It was a class full of fourth year students. Get to know the place that you're writing about.
Yeah. Especially when you go into newsrooms.
Get to know who your classmates are.
Yeah.
Because you shouldn't be writing for yourself. You can have a blog for that. But if your mission is to serve the university, the student body, and, you know, DePaul has some of the most military veterans of any other college in the state. You never hear about that.
So what do people need to know about being a community member of DePaul and figure out how to serve that?
A commuter student who has, you know, who's been in the military. I mean, it's a different life than what I think a lot of people who participate in student journalism think of as this kind of, like, you know, triangle of best case scenario, Loop, Lincoln Park, and my buddy's house in Wrigleyville.
Shady.
I mean, I'm a DePaul student. I'm allowed to say that.
And a commuter student for me.
And a commuter student, so I have a chip on my shoulder.
Yeah.
That's me being transparent about my lack of objectivity.
Mm-hmm. Anything else?
Then I think that wraps up this panel.
Cool. Thank you. One more? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
I guess all of you kind of, you know, answer this. And me and Ed, we talk online sometimes. We were talking beforehand about newsrooms. And I work at Sun Times, also teach a news reporting class here. Some of you my former students and students up there. So when you all go to newsrooms and today reached out to you all, the thing is like, hey, what are the conversations like when you go to newsrooms to tell them, basically tell them about themselves? Like, is it pushback or is it, hey, we know we fucked up?
Yeah,
sure.
Stop fucking up.
Yeah,
it really depends. There's such a spectrum. Like with Harkin, we used to operate a lot and kind of still do within this cheerleader model of like, there's one really excited producer or reporter who's like, we need to be doing Harkin because they're like the folks that can help us engage our audiences in this certain way. And like, there's someone that champions it. They don't always have like the institutional buy-in to actually make it happen. Sometimes they do, and they're the ones that have to push this boulder uphill of like, all right, let's just try it. And better case scenario, like the newsroom gets like Harkin or the folks where we can go to do engagement with, and they are like a streamlined system for doing it. And there's like, on the management level and, you know, just like the foot soldier level of like the producers, reporters, there's some buy-in for that. We haven't until, you know, the past year or so been like, how do we go out and try to sell to newsrooms that don't know they need us yet? A lot of the times it's just inbound interest. And we have like a really easy value proposition for like a public radio newsroom, for instance. That's where we've really borne it out. And then there's some newsrooms, you know, because basically it's like, that's our mission. Don't you want to be doing these things where you're serving curiosity? It'll help you survive, things like that. So they realize it is critical to their mission. And then for some newsrooms, to them, it's a harder sell. And a lot of them don't feel like they need it. And even like, yeah. So it's a spectrum. It's definitely a challenge. But there's, and a challenge on our end is just like, how do we keep supporting, you know, tiny newsrooms with two people that are like the only newsroom for hundreds of miles around and make sure they can afford like, and they have the resources to do it. So it's like there is this gulf of people that want it and know the mission but can't afford to do it versus like the people that can't afford us. Do we want to be focusing everything on them? And so.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think for us, like we're super collaborative. It's just like what we're known for, but a lot of times it is like the champion of a newsroom, like it's a journalist, it's not necessarily the newsroom itself.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, and I mean like, and you pick and choose your battles, you know, like I was like in like, it wasn't like a Twitter beef, but it was like I was like critiquing Report for America, and then dude who runs it was like, can we talk? And so like I made the choice to have the conversation with him because like, at the end of the day, like, he says his long game is the same as mine, sort of. And so, like, okay, well, how can I... And you just got all this money, and you have a platform, and so, like, how can I have this conversation with you to basically tell you, like, you're fucking up, and you know you are, so, like, admit it, and then actually show that you're listening to people. So, yeah, I mean, it's, like, it's a different, like, people receive it very differently. You know, we have newsrooms, like, approach us and ask us, like, hey, we're trying to figure out how to be more diverse. Like, can you help us type stuff? You know, and, like, a lot of that is, I'm like, okay, well, here's how you can pay us, you know, like, mm-hmm. one. And then, two, like, I don't know. It's just, it's also, like, are they actually really receptive? Or in those instances, it's like, is everyone receptive? Because, like, if everyone's receptive, then that's great. But in those instances, it's not good if you just have, like, a cheerleader. Like,
yeah.
If you kind of, like, so it really depends on the issue and, like, what's being asked. But, yeah. And, like, there are great newsrooms that are pretty self-aware. Like, we're partnering with WDET in Detroit, mm-hmm. and they know they're not great with community engagement. And so, but, and, like, the general manager sets that tone, and she's aware and, like, really open about it. So, yeah, so you have traditional newsrooms like that where, like, you have somebody in charge who gets it, but then you'll have, like, someone like the Sun-Times who, like, gets upset and, like, has Daryl come in to, like, try to talk to him about us, like, critiquing them, but, like, isn't really hearing us. Like, is just kind of trying to get us to see them as not a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, it's a funny and weird position to be in.
Mm-hmm.
My show has been trying to up our engagement game lately, outside of the traditional talk show format and call-in format, which has its faults. So for about a year, we've been trying to sign on with Harkin, which is a saga.
Yeah.
Our station already has a contract with Harkin for Curious City, but to get the shows to use it as a separate issue.
That's one of those siloing issues. Like, even though we started at BEZ, they think about it. They have historically thought about it as, we have one show that does that, and Worldview doesn't need to engage their audience in that way. Like, why would anyone else need to? But so I've been secretly pushing it from a lot of angles. But it's
an attitude of, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Sure.
And they said, well, Worldview has an audience, Worldview has a staff, Worldview can do call-ins, Worldview can... And I'm like, well, we want to do email engagement. And they're like, well, you know, we have a proprietary email list, and you can't do that because you're just one asset within the station. So it's like...
So Julian's trying, he's a champion.
It's an internal struggle, I think, in some cases.
A lot of it is.
You're the cheerleader there.
Yeah.
You're the one trying to...
He's a real rabble-rouser there.
That's so fun.
If you get that.
So he's also my boyfriend.
Yeah. For all, speaking of transparency.
A lot of shit. It's taught me a lot about BZ, but...
It's a great place to work.
No newsroom's a good place to work.
I think City Bureau
is. I love my job.
Is City Bureau is not a traditional newsroom?
No, not necessarily.
Yeah. Media organizations are tough. There's a lot of energy, interpersonal energy. That's a big part of it.
Resistance to change.
Yeah. Anyway, so are we done now?
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to keep anyone too late, but we'll linger around and chat. You can talk with us.
Thank you all.
Yeah. Wondering what to make for dinner.
I know, that's kind of it. I'm like, should I?
It doesn't have to be elaborate today. Where do you live?